I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Vice presidents don't get no respect. The first vice president, John Adams, said the vice president is the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. Calvin Coolidge remarked, I enjoyed my time as vice president. It never interfered with my mandatory 11 hours of sleep a day. Johnny Carson observed, democracy means that anyone can grow up to be the president, and anyone who doesn't grow up can be vice president. Our guest Amy Godion says that the role of the vice president has grown in importance through history. She's a visiting assistant professor of law at the Penn State Dickinson School of Law, where she teaches courses in constitutional law and national security law, and she joins us on Radio Times. And Amy Godion, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, and we'll try to fix that phone. Hopefully we can fix that phone. I'm going to try another question at you. Would you say the vice president or the office of the vice president has more respect today?
I think so. I would say it's been a pretty extraordinary increase in the vice president's power since the Constitutional Convention and the view of some of the framers of the office. Indeed, there's been a tremendous amount of scholarship on kind of the concept of the vice presidency. And to sum it up, I probably won't do it justice, but I'll try. As the many said, the vice presidency was really even an afterthought or maybe even an accident of some sort. It was viewed by many to kind of be a hybrid of either a legislative or an executive role, and really was seen more as a device to make sure that the electoral college functioned in a way that allowed the electors to select someone not from their state, or kind of force them to select someone not from their state for the office. So it was really viewed kind of as a device for the Electoral College. And if you look at the original Constitution, there's really only three sections that deal with the vice presidency. And really, you know, in addition to that device of the Electoral College, the vice president was really there to be a tiebreaker if there was, you know, an equally divided Senate vote.
Obviously presiding over the U.S. Senate, a job that the vice president still has. But why do you think that the framers thought so little of this job?
I think there's been a tremendous amount of scholarship on the history, and I think they just didn't see it as that much of a function within the executive branch. They didn't foresee that the vice president would be involved in policy making. Certainly, I don't think they foresaw that it would the vice president would have as significant a role as the office does today, particularly in the areas of foreign policy and national security.
When did that begin to change, or perhaps even under what presidency did that begin to change then?
Sure. If you look at kind of the arc of the vice presidency, there's kind of two frames that you see changing. First of all, you see that the vice president goes from being more of a symbol, just to go out and, greet diplomats or dignitaries, to really becoming a policymaker, both on the domestic front as well as the national security, foreign policy, foreign affairs front. The other arc that you see really is from having more of a legislative role, again, be the tiebreaker or just kind of part of the legislative branch, to really being in the executive branch and being a policymaker. And you really saw that Nixon is often credited with ushering in the theory of the modern vice presidency, and that's when he was serving as vice president under Eisenhower. But then you see Walter Mondale within the Carter administration. His tenure really put that theory of the modern vice presidency into practice.
And it's interesting that even the office of the vice presidency migrates from the Capitol to the White House and then to the West Wing over time, obviously showing that the growing importance of this particular job.
Absolutely. I think that's, that there's a number of different pieces of evidence that you could point to the increase in the staff of the vice president, probably from having one or two personal secretaries and maybe one other to a very extensive staff. I don't have the most recent figures today, but I believe under Cheney there were, it was close to a $4 million budget for the office of the vice president. So obviously there's a lot more staff and personnel that go with that. And then, of course, you have, as you said, the most tangible evidence is really that move in physical proximity from being in the Capitol, then to the White House, and then to the West Wing. And I think that really speaks to access to the president and the ability to not only influence those around or within the executive branch, but to really influence the president and be involved in the decision making at that level.
But as you have written, this is really a bipartisan effort, not necessarily by design, but that both Republican and Democratic presidents have empowered their vice presidents.
Absolutely. I think the you start to see again with Nixon and Mondale, but across the next few administrations, a real increase in the role of the vice president chairing executive branch commissions and task force. You saw Quayle chairing a number of them. You saw Gore, particularly in the Reinventing Government Initiative and some of the environmental and technology policies, really leading the policymaking process and on the executive branch side.
But does that tell us that just the job of being president has gotten so complicated that the president needs a wingman to help him out?
I think that's one piece of it. I think the other piece are some of the structural structural enhancements of the office, and by doing that I mean the now this has been since the late 40s, but right. The vice president sits as one of the statutory members on the National Security Council. That's a statutorily mandated role. After 9/11, we created the Homeland Security Council. The vice president also sits on that. Obviously, we've seen, again, this kind of general increase in the vice president, as you said, kind of serving as a wingman, both on the campaign trail, which we're seeing a lot of recently. I think sometimes we call the vice president the attack dog in chief, or, the vice president can serve as one of the real prominent fundraisers during a campaign. And in addition, they can kind of be a spokesperson for the administration, for its policies.
How do you see, at least from an outsider, the relationship between Vice President Joe Biden and President Obama?
Sure, and I think that's actually one of the interesting ones to contrast maybe with Bush and Cheney.
Right.
And I think in both those cases, what you have with the presidents coming in, with Bush and with Obama, was a lack of foreign policy credentials or experience. And so both Bush and Obama needed to kind of beef up that part of their package. So there was a lot of talk when they selected their vice presidential running mates that they needed to select someone who had that skill set. And I think they have. And I think what you see with the relationship with Biden and Obama is that President Obama really respects Vice President Biden's views on foreign policy and on national security. There have been a number of reports that Biden kind of ran the Iraq winding down operations and took control of that project, that Obama had asked him to take control of that project. There's also reports that Biden often plays the kind of contrarian role in national security debates, and that Obama has asked him to play that role and to kind of play, devil's advocate when they're dealing with something, whether it's from the bin Laden raid to, some of the more recent discussions about Afghanistan and the drawdown there.
And of course, Biden's his so many years that he spent in the U.S. Senate, I'm assuming that gives the president some connection there that he might not have by himself.
Sure, and I think that's a piece, too, that I would draw with the Cheney parallel, is both Biden and Cheney had tremendous contacts in the legislature, but also in the bureaucracy. And we're able to use those contacts and that experience to push through some of the policy goals of the separate administrations.
So does it make sense, because vice presidents are more empowered, that the selection of a vice president matters more to voters, or should matter more to voters?
Yes. In our view, my co-author and I, Doug Stewart, certainly, that's a big piece of it. And part of one of the reasons we started playing with this idea and this topic was, again, that it's been fairly well documented, the increase in the power of the vice president's office. But the area of national security has been pretty tremendous. And one of, when we were going through kind of the examples of that increase, one that I think the media and the public may not be as aware of is that in 2003, President Bush signed a new executive order which gave we revised an existing executive order, but which gave classification authority to the vice president. Mm. So what that means is the vice president now is an original classification authority. Whoever is in that role has the authority to classify information in the first instance. This, I think, really can be a very powerful tool in the office of the vice president, and I think it can lead both to controlling intelligence and information, and that gets into the whole kind of concept of the balance that we have in our country between secrecy and knowledge and access to knowledge. But it also means that the vice president can exert tremendous influence over national security and foreign policy.
Well, as we
and development.
As we all know, there's a vice presidential debate tonight. There's been so much hype leading up to this. Does that, and oftentimes the conventional wisdom is that the debate, it might be interesting, there might be some interesting zingers or one-liners, but it might not or hasn't really moved polls. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen tonight, but I'm curious what you'll be looking for.
Sure. Well, I think that you've got a pretty stark contrast between Biden and Paul Ryan, but I think the interesting thing is they're both policy wonks. And, you know, one of the criticisms of the presidential debate last week, regardless of who you thought won that debate, was that it was very policy heavy. Personally, I think that's a good thing, and I hope that we see some of that tonight. But I'd be very interested to hear, or I'll be looking to hear, their takes on the powers of the vice presidency and how they plan to exercise those powers, what type of relationship they envision having with the president. Obviously, Biden can speak to the relationship that he has, and he often does on the stump. And I'll be interested to hear how Paul Ryan speaks to that, too. But I'll be interested to hear, particularly for Paul Ryan, who does not have necessarily the foreign policy or national security background that Joe Biden does, what roles he thinks he'll play in those areas. My guess is he probably won't go out that far on it. He'll really talk more about the Romney-Ryan administration and their views on Iran or on Afghanistan or Syria. But that's what I'll be looking for, is kind of a sense of what Paul Ryan thinks his role as vice president will be in the national security and the foreign policy areas.
And we're almost out of time here, but any response to Mitt Romney picking Paul Ryan as his running mate?
I think it was really an effort to put the domestic issues front and center in the campaign, to really bring the economy, the budget, healthcare to be the issues that we'd be talking about during most of the campaign.
Well, Amy Godian, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Amy Godian is a visiting assistant professor of law at the Penn State Dickinson School of Law. She teaches courses in constitutional law and national security, getting us up to speed, or certainly some things to think about for the debate tonight between the two vice presidential candidates. We have another guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about whether campaigns do or do not matter. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Agnes Irwin School supports WHYY and is hosting an open house for all grades on Sunday, October 21st from 2 to 4 p.m. on its campus located at Ithan Avenue and Conestoga Road in Rosemont. With all-girls education pre-K through grade 12, families and prospective students are invited to meet students and faculty, tour the campus, and learn more about the Agnes Irwin experience firsthand. For more information, 610-525-8400 or online at agnesirwin.org.
You did it. You bought back a half a day during our fall FM membership campaign. I'm Marty Moscoane. This means that for the rest of the day, you won't be hearing live membership breaks. It also means we have a good head start towards achieving the goals of our membership campaign. If you contributed as part of our buyback effort, we thank you very much. If not, we still have a ways to go to reach our overall goal. So please visit WHYY.org right now and make a pledge of support. Thanks.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Early breast cancer detection means better outcomes. The Women's Cancer Center at Fox Chase offers an array of risk assessment, genetic counseling, and screening options. Fox Chase has been named a Breast Imaging Center of Excellence by the American College of Radiology for Mammography, Breast Ultrasound, Breast MRI, Ultrasound Guided Biopsy, and Stereotactic Biopsy. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the 2012 presidential and congressional elections are on track to be the most expensive ever. The presidential race could cost as much as $2.5 billion. So what are the candidates and their supporters getting for all that money? And just how important are the campaigns with their ads, the debates, the conventions, the polls, the speeches, the interviews, and the inevitable gaffes? Our guest is Temple University political science professor Christopher Vlezin. He tracks the course of presidential elections in his new book, The Timeline of Presidential Elections, How Campaigns Do and Do Not Matter. And Chris Vlezin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. And I know you're not a big fan of baseball metaphors, but you used one in your book in terms of a timeline, thinking about these campaigns that seem to go on forever and ever, not unlike the baseball season. Is that how we should think about campaigns, or certainly this one?
They do go on a long time.
They do.
And they go on a lot longer nowadays than they used to.
Yeah.
It's a really long baseball season.
But the idea in the beginning is we don't know anything.
At the beginning of the election year, based on history, and we could talk about how it's maybe changed a little bit over time, because it has changed.
Mm-hmm.
But based on the data we've used, which is for the last 15 election presidential elections since 1952, we know virtually nothing at the beginning of from the polls at the beginning of the election year about who's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
You're just as well off flipping a coin. Now, at the end of the cycle, we know a lot. Right? So we're heading into the polls at the end of the election campaign, we pretty much know who's going to win and pretty much by how much.
Well, and I do want to get to that, but looking at this timeline, it seems that, and this is looking at past polls and past election results, that mid-April, April-ish, things begin to coalesce. Voters begin to make up their minds, have opinions about the candidates who are running.
Yeah, between the beginning of the year. They think about it as happening during the nomination process. And so while we're picking either a candidate to challenge the incumbent or the two candidates who will ultimately run, where there's a 3 or 4 month period when people are really starting to focus on the campaign, and preferences are starting to crystallize, but they're not done yet.
Right.
We're only about maybe half the way, maybe not quite.
But is it based on advertising? There's probably minimal advertising, but there's some advertising early in the year. Debate performances, interviews, how the press covers. What are all the variables, I guess, that influence a voter's opinion?
Well, I would say all of that. We don't really, in this book, we don't try to parse the actual specific ways in which people are getting information and how it matters. What we're really interested in is what's happening during that season. And there's a lot of things happening during the season. One thing is the candidates are becoming clear. We may know one going into the spring, but by the time we're done, we usually know two. Maybe 2008 was one exception where it took at least deep into the spring. But it was becoming increasingly clear even by April. And as candidates, once we have candidates, we can actually begin to think about which one we'd prefer. As that happens, people start thinking about whether or not they want to stay the course, whether they want to change. How are things going? Are they looking good? Are they looking bad? They haven't fully completed that assessment, but they start doing that during the spring, and that's what our data show.
And is it based on their opinion about the candidate or particular issues, you think, that get people thinking one way or the other?
Well, early on, it looks to be that what people are really doing is assessing the state of it's kind of what we would call a retrospective judgment. We're looking at whether or not we want to stay the course or change. How are things going? Is the president doing a good job? Is the economy going in the right direction? Do we want to continue with this president or with a successor to this president of the same party? Those are the kinds of things that are first coming into play. Other things then factor in as time goes by.
And I'm assuming some of that is just looking at one's own life, right? I mean, how am I doing under this particular president?
How am I doing? How are other people doing? People, interestingly, when they're looking at things like the economy, for instance, people may be self-interested, but they don't necessarily hold presidents and other politicians accountable for what's happening in their own personal lives, which can be affected by a lot of fairly specific things. They're interested in, are things getting better for all of us, which will benefit me, but it will benefit other people as well. How's the nation doing as a whole?
People actually think that. I shouldn't sound so shocked and surprised. So people think that way beyond their own self-interest, you think?
Well, I don't think that's unrelated to their self-interest.
Okay.
I just think, you know, if I have a boss who I don't get along with and he or she happened to fire me or not give me a raise this year, I don't think I'm going to necessarily go hold President Obama responsible.
Right.
But I might if this my prospects for employment and prospects for a raise along with yours and others around me are going up or going down.
Well, and we get job numbers every month. We get weekly, you know, jobless reports. There
right.
is a lot of information. How do you see that influencing how voters think about candidates?
That's a big.
I mean, we digest all that stuff, and probably you do as well. But I wonder, you know, whether regular, normal people think in those terms.
Well, they do. They do put together this information. It's interesting what we find in the book. I think it's interesting is what's happening by April. The economic election day economic cake is largely baked. We pretty much know from conditions where things are. And what's really important here is growth. And so it's not really the level of the economy. It's we could talk more about that if you want. It's really the direction, the slope of the economy that matters. And that's pretty clear by April, May, June. Voters haven't fully factored it in yet. And so while we can look at objective data and pretty much tell where things right. are going to head and are heading, voters haven't yet fully factored that into their electoral preferences. They've started to, as I've said, but that continues as the election cycle unfolds.
But are you saying that to a large extent by April or spring, we pretty much know how a candidate and a campaign is going to go and how it's going to end up?
It depends on what you mean by pretty much.
Spoken like a true political scientist, right?
Well, it's a probabilistic world.
It is
right?
a probabilistic world, yes.
We'll die and we'll pay taxes in the meantime, and,
yes.
and somebody will win. And we have a pretty good idea by April or May what's likely to happen. But what happens in between April, May, and Election Day also
right.
matter.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, talking with Christopher Valesian, and he's a Temple University political science professor and is co-author of a book called The Timeline of Presidential Elections with an interesting subtitle, How Campaigns Do and Do Not Matter. We are, of course, in the throes of a fascinating campaign, whether it's a presidential campaign, some interesting congressional races as well. And lines open. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9400. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Does it, though, make sense? I mean, if things are sort of baked, how important is it to run a good campaign?
Well, it's to say they're baked.
Or half-baked, perhaps.
Well, what I meant by that, really, is the state of the economy as it's going to matter, right, on Election Day, for instance, is already pretty clear to people. That doesn't mean it's going to have necessarily the same effect in each election year. So, for instance, a good economy, a good example of this is 2000 election. It's a really, really nice economy, really, really a president who many people approved of and still approve of.
This would be Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton, right. It looks like he has this candidate Gore's, Vice President Gore's election to lose. And didn't quite lose it, until, at least from the point of view of the popular vote, and did in the Electoral College, which is a whole different story. Well, what this tells us is that, you know, there's an advantage there. The way to look at this, there's an advantage, and in many years, most years, candidates seize those advantages. In some years, they don't. And so what they do during the course of the campaigns can matter.
And he did distance himself from Clinton, probably for a whole host of reasons, right?
Well, he distanced himself. He maybe didn't take credit for the parts of the Clinton record which didn't involve
Monica.
Things. Yeah, didn't involve Monica. But there's also things that there's also evidence that he sort of shifted a little bit to the left and ideologically who became President Bush shifted towards the middle, and that also cost him.
What about, there's often this talk about likability and this, you know, crazy notion, you know, could you have a beer with this person? Not that it would ever happen, except in very rare instances. But does when you look at polls and polling, how does that likability thing factor in?
It's really tricky, this stuff. Part of the problem with this kind of thing is it's always any kind of subjective assessment is it's going to be clouded by people's lenses. If you have blue lenses on, you tend to see blue, and if you have red lenses on, you tend to see red. And this is well known, but it affects whether or not you think somebody's likable or is a strong leader or cares about people like me and the like. So that's the first limit to these kinds of analyses. You know, beyond that, you know, it doesn't mean that all of our assessments of all of these candidates are equally contaminated. And so to the extent there is an advantage in likability for one candidate over another, that presumably tells us something about what people really think. And whether it matters on election day is going to matter on, you know, how things all fit together and how things come together.
So what you're saying is that Republicans think that Romney is likable? And Democrats think that Obama is likable.
Well, they're more likely to think that, right, that that's the case. Yeah, that's precisely.
And does that get us to that whole confirmation bias thing, where which is that we sort of seek out opinions and beliefs that reinforce and underscore what we believe anyway?
Well, yeah, that's one thing. It also may be just that there are aspects of things, of personalities that we like that are different from what others. I mean, I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying there, but it's also the case that we just are seeing different things. You know, that I may be emphasizing parts of a personality that are different to what you might emphasize, and the Democratic and Republican candidates may tend to reflect those differences.
You also say, or seem to indicate, that, and there's a lot of talk about these undecided voters, the seven of them that are left, but you really say that they're probably uninterested voters.
Well, the undecided voters, those who are undecided now and who will vote, are more interested than those who are undecided and won't vote. That's one thing. But yes, so that's an important difference, and a big difference. They are the undecided voters are also, but they are a lot less interested than those who have decided, and particularly those strong Democrats and strong Republicans who've been decided from early on in the year.
And is partisan, I mean, party affiliation, is that still strong these days?
Yes, very strong.
Even though everyone says that they're an independent or they think independent.
That's not true anymore. That was true. It wasn't everyone, but it was a lot more true back in the 70s than it is today. And it's been we've seen a decline in the number of independents, pure independent. A lot of people will consider themselves independents, but if you ask them, do you lean towards the Democrats or lean toward the Republicans? Most people in a growing percentage say yes.
Oh, that's
and that's
interesting.
And it's about as telling about what people will do in the voting booth as somebody who says I'm a Democrat or Republican.
Mm-hmm. Meaning that they probably will vote for the candidate of their party.
Yes.
That they affiliate.
Well, that's in this case they're lean.
Or they're lean. Exactly. Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, talking about the importance or perhaps even the unimportance of campaigns. And, of course, we're in the throes of a pretty interesting presidential campaign and some interesting congressional races as well. 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Joan from Newtown Square to join us. And, Joan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is about the length of the campaign. You know, it just goes on way too long. And I was just wondering, do you think it's feasible that Congress would ever pass a law limiting the timeline on a campaign for maybe 6 months or something like that?
Go ahead, Chris.
I can't imagine that happening. I mean, it's really in the hands of the parties, and I think the parties are having enough time keeping it within the election year. Mm-hmm. As you know, in the last couple of cycles, we were flirting with crossing over, and that hasn't stopped the. I think from a political science, that's the official sort of story, right? The official side of the campaign, but from a political science point of view. The campaign is really up to the candidates, and we see, you know, beginning on November 7th, candidates will be positioning for 2016 if they haven't done so already.
Going to New Hampshire and, I mean, doing all those things that
forming committees, raising money, right? All kinds.
But is that also because we are a country that values speech and campaigning, you know, go hand in hand?
Speech and campaigning go hand in hand. I think people look for an edge. One thing that we've learned is that as we've stepped back in time, people people watch, people show up. So it's mm-hmm. not, you know, the expectation that people won't be there the year before the election years was wrong. Mm-hmm. I remember teaching a presidency course in 2008 and didn't have really expect any current events. It was, no, it means 2007. It was the year before the election. Sure enough, we have debates and debates and debates and debates, and they've been going on a long time. And that's it's people are showing up. Media yeah. organizations are happy to broadcast it.
Indeed. And I do want to ask about the media and also about the debates. We have one tonight between the two vice presidential candidates. Had one last week, the first one between the two presidential candidates. So do debates matter? And it's interesting, Romney got a bit of a bounce after the last debate, and the president got a lot of criticism, not just from Republicans, but from members of his own party and supporters.
Yeah, well, the debates, do debates matter question is there's a multiple answers to this, if it's okay. I'll keep it. There's
no,
a pretty straightforward.
Go for it.
Well, one thing we're interested, in the book, we focus in particular on the debate season. So we're interested in what happens from the beginning of the debate season. So where do things stand going into the first debate to the end of the debate season? Where do things stand when we get clear, when the dust settles from the last debate, whether it's two or three or four? And what we find during that period is there's only one there's not much change over that period, net. Now, there may be lots of change in between, and I could talk about a little bit in a moment, but there's
sure.
not much change net at all. And there's only one time in which the lead actually did change, and that was in 2000 when Gore went into the first debate with a very tiny half-point lead, one-point lead, and ended up behind about a point and a half. But then he ended up, the popular vote at least, winning. We find that the first debate, though, does have more of an effect. And typically, it's interesting, it's typically the case that the in-party loses. So
Who's the in-party candidate?
Yeah, whether it's an incumbent or not, tends to lose about a point and a quarter on average. There's one very glaring exception to this, and it's 1976 when Ford and just gained and gained and gained throughout the whole fall, seemingly having very little to do at all with the debates because it had begun before, had continued after, and his debate performance is famous mm-hmm. for his claim that the Soviet Union was not dominating Eastern Europe, which didn't seem to really – it doesn't seem to have been a benefit to him.
So even Reagan had a poor first debate performance?
Yeah, 1984, Reagan assisted to, and he there actually in 1984 we see that's flat. Other than that, we're looking at basically everything is we're looking at 2004 2008 we see 2 point drops, other years 1.5 point drops. You know, there's the glaring exception of 76 and then this flat 1984 case.
Let's take a very short break, and then I do want to pick up on that. Talking with Christopher Valesian, and he is Temple University. I've pronounced his name 7 different ways during our hour. I hope one of those ways was correct. Christopher Valesian, and he is the author, a co-author of a new book called The Timeline of Presidential Elections, How Campaigns Do and Do Not Matter. He's a political science professor at Temple University, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Candlewick Press, publishers of John Klassen's new picture book, This Is Not My Hat. Follow-up to the New York Times bestseller, I Want My Hat Back. This Is Not My Hat, available in bookstores and online retailers now.
Delaware Valley College supports WHYY and presents the Social Business Future Conference, Friday, November 9th, on the college campus in Doylestown, PA. This full-day business conference and planning retreat is designed for executive leaders, HR professionals, marketers, educators, corporate trainers, and business owners looking to move their organizations beyond the basics of social media. Full information and registration is online at thesocialbusinessfuture.com.
I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is a 30-second membership spot and not a live membership break because of you. You pledged before the October FM campaign so that you could hear more news, information, and interviews and less membership messages. That's because you enjoy the programs we present every day on WHYY. If you contributed as part of our buyback effort, thank you very much. If not, please visit WHYY.org right now and make a pledge of support. Thanks very much.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network. They offer access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach to care, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Temple University political science professor Christopher Vlezhin. And he's got a new book co-authored called The Timeline of Presidential Elections, How Campaigns Do and Do Not Matter. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about the conventions and also get back to our callers, but also to make sure I understand what you're saying about debates, since we're in the middle of the debate season. They'll be done by the end of October. Because it's interesting that Romney got a bit of a bounce out of the first debate. It'll be interesting to see what happens tonight and, of course, the second or the third and fourth presidential debate. But you're saying, looking back over time, over history, while there might be blips in the middle, when all is said and done, the debate performances don't really matter quite that much? Or maybe as much as people think they do?
Well, they don't. Maybe I think that's the best way to think about it. We don't say they don't matter. They don't matter a lot. They certainly matter, based on our analysis, a lot less than conventions. So the question is, do they matter more than other things? I think that's really, in an election like this, lots of things matter.
Sure.
Now, it's really hard to deny that something happened last Wednesday night, and something's happened in the first debates in other years. But what happens typically, why is there an effect, tends to be an effect in the first debate, and tends to be a pretty systematic effect. We know pretty much what's going to happen. But it doesn't really last. Well, there's two possibilities. One is that these effects don't last. They decay. So we get a little bounce, and it drops off. And maybe there's something that lasts, but some that doesn't last. Okay, that's part of it. So part of it decays, and then secondly, it could be counterbalanced by the other debates. That one could be a contrasting winner. Obama may come back and win next week, counterbalancing Romney's win on Wednesday. In which case, we maybe see something somewhere maybe in between where we were in the polls last week and where we are now.
And what do you think the influence of the over-caffeinated press is on polls or how people think about candidates or even how these campaigns kind of ebb and flow?
Well, it's hard to separate the press from any of this, right? I mean, we don't we're not watching the campaigns live. I mean, even those of us watching on C-SPAN, that's just a little tiny snapshot of what's going on, a sample. So we're missing most of the action, no matter what we try to do. And so it has to be mediated for us, and it is mediated for us. And so they have a big effect. And there's a lot of research on that, but that's not something we are spending a whole lot of time with. It's very interesting, though, is that one of the reasons why debates – people wonder why do debates have so limited effects, say, by comparison with conventions. And I think there's a part of them – part of it is a media story that you look at – debates are – conventions are typically considered pretty inconsequential because we don't pick candidates anymore. We're not really having platform battles. But what it does do is it gives parties and candidates, increasingly the candidates themselves, a chance to really run things for 3 days. And it's also something that's reported on for three solid days. I mean, most political reporters are in – we're in Florida, we're in Charlotte, and they were covering these two conventions, and that gets reflected to us. And they're prepared to give us very, very positive news that emphasizes their point of view. The candidates are and the conventions are, and that gets reflected, and it's unavoidable. And so there's a flow of positive news coverage. So it bounces up, and there's a flow of positive news coverage in the other direction, and it bounces down. But then we end up somewhere different from where we began oftentimes, and that matters. Whereas in debates, it's not one-sided. It's two-sided.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, if you're the Obama administration or the Romney candidacy, it looks pretty one-sided. but my guess is that's not going to last.
Because at conventions, it's the parties that really control the message, even though journalists want to be independent and want to not feel like you're just a PR machine. But it tends to be positive press that comes out of conventions.
Well, there is a show, and there's a reporting of the show. It's hard to avoid Clinton's speech, right? It's hard to avoid Clint Eastwood's speech as well. Right? Part of the story to begin with.
A reality show, sort of of sorts, I guess.
Yeah, that is part of it, yes. It's also the case that the conventions do a really good job, the parties do a really good job of not giving much raw material You noticed there was a little bit of a flare-up for about, it looked like for about 10 minutes at the Democratic convention about Jerusalem and other things. And nobody wanted to talk about it.
And they can just shut it down.
Well, the Democrats, if you can't find a Democratic politician who wants to talk about it, it's really hard to write a news story.
Interesting. Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking about the way we run presidential and congressional campaigns. And our guest is Christopher Vlejan, and he is a political science professor at Temple University. Let's see what Warren from Devon has to say. And Warren, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Chris, I think that millions of Americans are sick and tired of this bantering back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, and I want to know what you think it would take to get a legitimate third party continuous year after year to have a field of candidate that the American people could be satisfied with. And I'll take your answer off the air.
It's a big question, Warren. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you have any thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, my thoughts are probably not what he wants to hear.
Go ahead.
It'd probably take a fundamental change in how we, in our electoral system, which is something that's not likely to happen. The nature of our elections, really, the fact that we have these single-member districts and plurality elections really, really strongly encourages the existence of two parties, not just here, but in other countries where we have it. And where we don't have it in other countries, it's typically for some historical reasons having to do with regional concentrations of support and the like. And so it's hard. And this was true. It's true in Canada. It was true to some extent, it's true in at least starting things in the U.K. with the Liberal Democratic Party. Other things have since taken over. But it's just really hard to imagine. And the parties also, there's one thing they can agree on is, you know, having each other as opponents and not others. And so it's not easy. It's just not easy for third parties, even to the extent there is support out there.
And parties do a very good job. And Pennsylvania, I think, is a good example of that, of making it difficult for third-party candidates to even get on the ballot.
Yeah, let alone third parties. Exactly.
Right, exactly. Warren, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Tony from Winona has to say. And Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks, Marty. I listen to the show religiously, and I thank you for the time. My question is this. How effective do you think it is for Hawaii Governor Romney to have a position for the past 18 months on a specific subject and then say something different, i.e. in the debates as well as in press conferences, and have his campaign walk it back an hour or two later? And at what point, and whose job is it to call these facts to fruition? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Tony, thanks for calling into Radio Times. It sounds like he's referring back to the first presidential debate. do you have thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, I wish I could ask Tony, because I have a sneaking suspicion he would say one of two, and maybe both, and one would be President Obama, and which is the one I would say, and then two reporters and mass media. You know, I tend to order Obama first and the media second, because if he's not going to do that, then what should the media be doing? In terms of what, if the question began about what about Romney's strategy, based on our data, nobody who's been behind in the polls at the entering into this point of the campaign last week has ever won the popular vote, at least. And again, this goes back to the 2000 exception, which is really not about vote intention. So that's, I think they know that, and they know that, and they were behind, and it looked like they were behind about 3 points, and that doesn't seem insurmountable by historical standards, but there's not a lot of movement, right? Hmm. I mean, look at this. I mean, since last Wednesday, when the biggest win ever accomplished in presidential debate, the polls have maybe moved a point and a half, right? At least Obama's shares maybe lost a point and a half, and Romney's gained a point and a half. It's not a massive shift. So what were they thinking? I think what they're thinking is we got to move to the middle, and we have to try something. We have to go to the middle, and they tried, and they got away with it, right? From the point of view of the debate itself, nobody really called them on it, and that's the nature of politics and political debates.
Well, it'll be interesting to see or hear what happens tonight, and obviously looking at the other debates as well. Tony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, talking about presidential elections, campaigns, whether they do or do not matter. Let me ask you a little bit about ads, and I've sort of lost track of how much money has been invested in ads this go-round, but I know it's millions and it probably will be billions when all is said and done. Have you looked at whether ads, if they work sort of generically speaking, and if you live in Ohio, apparently you cannot turn on your television set without being just bombarded with ads. Has anyone looked about the effectiveness of just a blizzard of ads directed at voters, whether it turns them off? Does it inspire them? Does it change their mind?
Well, it depends. Not all ads are created equal.
No, indeed.
So if we could just generalize and say the average ad, what we find, and this is hard to study, and you could imagine, right, trying to parse the effects of particular ads. But we have some pretty good studies on ad volume, and we also have some isolated studies, some really neat field experiment studies where political scientists were allowed to vary ads. And what they found is that that advertising does tend to shape preferences. It does tend to shift preferences. But it's not clear that the shifts are particularly long-lasting. And so if you stop advertising, if you continue advertising, you continue to get the benefit. But when you stop advertising, the benefit seemingly dissipates, decays.
And does it matter if it's a positive? I mean, if it's positive about oneself or negative about one's opponent, does that in any way influence how people think about candidates?
Well, there aren't a whole lot of positive ads.
Right.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But I think my sense is it would be hard to. One of the problems we have is what makes an ad negative. Right. I mean, if I say that your position is such and such, and you're misrepresenting your position, is that a negative ad?
Hmm. Depends if it's true or not. I mean, it seems to me if it's true, I don't think that's necessarily a negative ad.
Yeah. Well, others might disagree.
So has this been an interesting year, I mean, to be a political science professor to look at this campaign? Or are in the end they're all sort of the same?
No, they're not all the same. They're all different. I mean, all we're trying to do is generalize from them. Mm-hmm. What can we tell in general about the similarities across the campaigns? And it's also when you write a book like this and you do sort of hint at sort of the structure and predictability and you watch a campaign in a very different way.
Yeah.
So you see the ups and downs and you're very sensitive to them. Does this mean that something's gone awry? I mean, one of the lessons of forecasting is when your forecasts, are clearly off the mark, at some point you realize you're missing something, right? That something's not in your model. And so if you are looking at this point of view, this is how I expect it to play out, and it doesn't quite play out, you're always wondering, can I learn something from that?
Sure. And do you is part of your job just to look at polls and deconstruct them and figure out how they're framing questions and whether it's likely voters or registered voters? Is all that matter then?
Well, in the
work
poll,
that you do?
Yes. I mean, it makes it really hard for all of us, I think, doesn't it?
I don't know even how to keep up with it personally.
Well, the polling organizations differ so much, right, in what they do. And some of these differences are kind of consistent, like the way they weight party identification, or the weighting for the age, or the weighting for race, or the weighting for income level. And they're usually doing it based on history. But there's different histories out there, right? And is this going to be the same as the past? And so these organizations tend to – they give very consistently more sort of pro-Romney or more pro-Obama net polls. But then they also – some of them vary a lot. And this could partly be due to what you said, whether they're using likely voters or registered voters. How are they deciding whether somebody's likely? Can likelihood change? I mean, I get enthusiastic, say, after the debate. Am I now more likely to vote on election day than I was before, say, the debate on Wednesday night?
And that likely voter then could become unlikely maybe the next week. Is that what you're saying?
That's
as well?
That's possible, yes.
Anything is possible. Let me see what Helene from Wilmington has to say. Helene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'd really like to know what it would take to get rid of the two conventions for both sides. It's a waste of money. At the end of during the convention, everyone who's speaking is going to be for the candidate. It's a bunch of, he's so great, we love him, blah, 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 let's thank his family, let's parade his family across this is such a waste of money. It's a boondoggle.
Well,
what can we do to get rid of this?
Well, and I'm tossing that back to you, Chris. Go ahead.
Not much. I think the reason is that the parties want it. And the candidates want it, and so they're.
And apparently, it works.
And,
right?
and we cover it. It works in the sense that the media is there in droves, and they're covering it. We're craving the coverage back home, whether on the newspaper or TV, or increasingly on the blogs. And they have effects on the outcome. In fact, they're the
Did
events.
They really?
They're the events that most matter. During the course, believe it or not, during the course of the election
even
campaign.
Even in 2012 or even in our contemporary times.
Yes, less than they have in the past. Mm-hmm. But as you saw, President Obama came out with a 5-point lead that dropped to a 3-point lead, but he sustained that, seemingly to be undone by the first presidential debate. Yeah.
Well, Helene, sorry about that. Thanks, though, for calling into Radio Times. We're almost out of time here, but there is always that unpredictable thing that can happen in the last couple of weeks of an election.
Yes.
You know, whether it's something tragic or hopefully not, but nonetheless, I'm assuming that's also a variable.
It's a variable, but it's a hard variable to measure and also a very hard variable to foresee. One of the reasons why, for instance, for so much attention paid to presidential debates is because they are a contest between the two, but we could foresee them. There are lots of other things that will happen or can happen that we can't really foresee during the course of this fall general election campaign. Maybe there'll be a revelation about a DUI in somebody's past, as we saw in 2000. Maybe it'll have an impact. We'll find out soon enough.
Well, stay tuned. And Christopher Vlejen, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And you're welcome. He's a political science professor at Temple University, a co-author of The Timeline of Presidential Elections, How Campaigns Do and Do Not Matter. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org. In fact, if you go to our website, you can also check out our in-studio photos. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr, and visit our expanded website at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.